Accession number 30624, reel 5.
Accession number 30624, Mr. Murray Pevan, reel 4. Now, we've gone to the time when you've gone to 36 service flying training school at Penhold in Alberta. And we were talking about, you know, your training on the Oxford. And you said one of the first things they did was train you on various things where engines fail and that kind of thing. Can you take us through what you can remember of that?
Well, briefly, the Oxford was a twin-engine trainer, and anybody who flew anything other than single-engine aircraft would have gone through training on it. And, of course, if you think about it, if it needs two engines to get it up into the air, if one of them fails, and it's then you have asymmetric power only, and if you're at low speed, for example, just after takeoff, you've got real problems, and you've got to be trained to react very, very quickly, or else you're just going to go straight in and kill yourself. And one of the things is to, A, decide quickly which engine on which side had failed, and then to take appropriate control action.
Now, what is the appropriate control action?
Well, if you think about it, you've got an aircraft with an engine on each wing, and it's just climbing out after takeoff. It needs all its power. It's trying to climb. It's got a very low airspeed. And the worst thing that can happen is if it stalls, which can then go into a spin and you'll go straight in. So you've got to take immediate action with the rudder, with opposite rudder. And this has the effect of, as it were, of balancing the thrust on one side only, so that the aircraft is then able to go straight ahead, not yaw. Think of skid in a car. If it yaws, it's presenting so much surface area to the wind that its air resistance goes up so much that the engine doesn't have power and you can't control it. If the aircraft is going cleanly through the air and you lower the nose to try and increase your airspeed and you've got power, maximum power on the surviving engine, you've got a chance. And one of the things, for example, was which way to turn. You can't turn against the good engine. You've got to turn with the good engine. So you're taught how to recognise one engine has gone, what to do immediately, then to, as it were, get the aircraft back on an even keel so that at least it's staying in the air, not losing any height, and then to decide how you can get it back to an airfield or a place where it's safe to land. And you're so taught and so quickly that you do this instinctively. And that's why it's one of the very early drills. The moment you got in the aircraft and got used to flying a very much heavier aircraft with different sort of controls, because you've now got your hockey stick, your spectacles, your pair of spectacles, instead of just a stick, it's a very different feel in the aircraft. It's a cabin aircraft.
Now, are there any other particular new drills that you're doing with the Oxford in training period at Penhold that you can think of?
No, I'm looking back through my logbook at this moment in time and seeing what was I had to do before my solo check. And basically, it's much the same as that which I did in the single-engined aircraft. I see here we've got action event of a fire, abandoning of the aircraft. In other words, if all goes by, you jump out the back, the side door, which again was an interesting thing because in the Oxford, to abandon the aircraft, you had to go out of a door at the side. And this meant walking back behind the centre of gravity. And as you did this, the nose of the aircraft would inevitably go up, which meant it would start climbing, it would start losing airspeed, and it would inevitably, very, very quickly thereafter, stall. So the name of the game... Oh, can you answer? Yeah. So the thing is this, that... The problem was, for example, supposing the engines went and you were relatively high up, and not only you, but the other members of the aircraft would try and abandon the aircraft. As one or more went backwards, even if you trimmed it to fly with the nose down, the balance of it would cause the nose to go up. And then you would go into a spin. And once you'd gone into a spin, there was no way of getting out of the aircraft because... centrifugal force would force you back. And this caused a lot of fatalities until they decided to have a piece of knotted rope installed along the side of the fuselage at the back. people were supposed to hang on to that. The only problem was, if you tried to open the door, it would open about 3 inches, and it wouldn't open any further. So then they decided they had to have a handle there whereby you could jettison the door, so that as you pulled the handle, the door would catch the wind, and then it would fly away, and you'd be able to jump out.
You were learning all that. Anything else you remember from that time?
No, except that it was a very, very different experience, because you had a high-powered aircraft. You were landing on a proper runway, not grass. It was much faster. Things were happening. You had retractable undercarriage. So in other words, you had to remember to put the wheels down.
I can see there's lots and lots of single engine flying and landing.
There's almost
more of it than anything else.
Well, they had to ingrain this into your head so that every action was automatic. And once they got that, then of course they went on with the rest of the syllabus.
What did you think of the instructors you had there?
Oh, they were incredibly good. I can't fault the quality of the training you got. Considering in the middle of a war, which, you know, could have meant the end of humanity, if you like, they took this infinite trouble with us. But then they needed us. They needed pilots.
So they
supporting.
Were all good?
They were all good. They wouldn't have been instructors if they hadn't been good.
Because you had a lot there, Potts, Dunnett,
yeah,
Smith,
yeah, yeah.
Wallace.
Well, if I tell you that this airfield, I think I once wrote down all the different registration numbers of the aircraft I flew. I think I went through 60 different aircraft during my time there, which meant they must have had about 120 on site, which meant that they had to have the organisation for maintaining them and servicing them and fueling them. It was an enormous undertaking. There were three flights of 60 on each, six courses. There were three courses going through simultaneously, month one, then another month after, then another month after. And all these were going through all the time, so that every month a course graduated.
Now, anything else happening that you recall, or any incidents in your flying there?
Well, yes, one thing that was, of course, quite astonishing was the Canadian winter.
Now tell me about that.
It was horrific. I mean, the snow really came down, and we were totally unused to it. They used to us with little fur hats, just like the Russians use. Well, the officers got fur, we got cloth. And these had flaps you could pull down at the side and tie underneath your chin to keep your ears warm.
And how bad was it?
The snow was bad, but we flew in all weathers. There was no let-up. And, of course, some of the idiosyncrasies of the aircraft in very cold conditions, they had radial air-cooled engines, and they stood out overnight. And anybody who knows anything about engines would know that this would cause the oils to freeze up, which meant if you tried to start the engines, the bottom cylinders would have oil there, and as the cylinders came down when they were turning the engine to start it, it would just bust the crankshaft. So they had to put fires underneath them or pump hot air around them. And this was a North American common thing, but something we'd never seen before.
And what about icing up in flight? Was that a problem?
Oh, that was a problem, yeah. Oh, obviously.
Tell us about that.
Well, you had to be very observant to see that, well, A, you tried to avoid potential of icing, which meant try avoid cloud. If it was raining and if it was very, very cold, then they wouldn't send you up if it was an obvious icing potential situation. But some of the things that happened were quite bizarre. For example, later on when we got onto night flying, one night, one of the pupils failed to return. So we all sent out on searches the next day, and each of us were given a little area to search. And the aircraft was never found. And then it turned out that what had happened was he crashed into a lake, broke through the ice, disappeared underneath, which the ice then reformed on top, fresh snow came down, there was no visible sign of the aircraft. So that was somebody. It was unfortunate.
Any other incidents like that?
All the usual incidents, people getting lost and people being failed and minor incidents. people taxiing in, having successfully completed the detail, switching everything off, and then lifting the wheels up so it settled down. Chiefy would go mad, come out screaming and shouting. Things like that. I was once hauled out of bed at night by some of the guys who'd got drunk and tossed out onto the ice rink at the back in my pyjamas, which I wasn't very pleased about. But all in all, it was a hard going, but it was, I think the satisfaction of getting on top of the aircraft was the thing.
And you just kept grafting away at it. I mean, you're working all the way through.
I think we had one break for 2 days, which was the New Year's. We had a Christmas meal, which all the officers served us at.
What do you remember about that, the Christmas celebrations?
I've got a menu for it somewhere, which all the officers and guys signed. It's in that pile over there. But it was good fun. I mean, it was remote. There was nowhere near it. There was a town called Red Deer, but there was nothing in Red Deer. So it wasn't worth going to. And anyway, we didn't have transport. But What happened?
Well, you're there till what, February, aren't you? So
there to right through the heart of the winter, yeah. So most of our advanced training at that station was in fact under winter conditions.
What about cross country? Any problems with that?
Yes, I got lost once because
tell us about that.
There were solo cross countries, there's dual cross countries. Dual cross countries, one of you acted as a navigator, and of course everything was snow covered, and I just made a mistake in my calculations, and we went on, and by the time we got to where we should have been, and should have been somewhere near it, all we could see was white fields underneath. And there are no landmarks there because all the roads either go north and south or east and west, so it all looks the same.
So what happened at the end of the course?
At the end of the course, we're all fearful, would we or would we not pass out? One thing I haven't mentioned up to now, of course, is that you only flew half the day. You either flew in the morning or the afternoon, swapping over the aircraft with other courses. And ground subjects got stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. Navigation, radio.
The ground. We haven't done much about the ground.
No.
So what were you doing?
Well, all sorts of different subjects. Radio, navigation, engineering, airmanship.
What's airmanship?
Well, aspects of flying an aircraft that you can study on the ground. How and why an aircraft flies, what to do under different circumstances, advanced aerodynamics. We had lectures by people who came along who'd been on operations and who'd come over and were going around the schools lecturing on their experiences and what they'd done and what they'd had to do and so forth and so on. Giving the benefit of their experience. We had examinations all the time, proper examinations, and you had to pass, you had to get a satisfactory pass, or you were turfed out. They were ruthless about rooting out anybody that wasn't up to scratch. They weren't going to waste
time. Did many fail?
Yes, about 15%, I think, was the standard. In some respects, I was lucky because the majority of the guys on the particular course that I was on were ex-University Air Squadron. It was just pure coincidence that the 60 of us included me and about four or five others who weren't ex-University Air Squadron. It just came about as you got mixed up but in England before you left. So I was up against a very tough bunch.
So what happened at the end?
At the end, we were all called in and we told that we'd all... Well, we knew we'd passed out because we got our pass-out checks. We had various checks out with the CFI, Chief Flying Instructor, day flying, night flying, navigation, manoeuvres, all sorts of things. And then eventually we were all paraded and told who'd got their wings. The ones who hadn't were out within 5 minutes. And they were gone and disappeared.
And what was your rank on passing out?
Sergeant.
And just sergeant?
Yes, yeah, sergeant pilot, yeah. There were six commissions given. I came sixth in the course. The commissions were given to number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 7. all except University Air Squadron. All I wanted was the wings.
You weren't that bothered then?
I couldn't care less, no. Just wanted me wings, that's all.
Now, so where to then?
Well, then we went, I was given, astonishingly, a month's leave. I couldn't believe it. And I went straight down to Chicago via bus and train. The journey of my life.
What do you remember of it?
It was unbelievable because my father's brother, who I'd never met, he'd lived there for about 30 years. And it was like going to Wonderland. 2 days later, I'm in Chicago, driving along in his car, a great big black car. This avenue of skyscrapers. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. It was incredible. Anyway, after that incredible month,
So what do you spend the month doing?
Enjoying myself. Because nobody had seen an RAF uniform before, and that was a matter of great curiosity wherever I went and whatever I did. So I would say eating and getting presents from my family. My uncle was generous. He gave me some. He put me up in a hotel and gave me spending money every day. And it took about 4 or 5 days to get there, and about 4 or 5 days to get. And then I had to report to Moncton, New Brunswick, which was the depot from which we were to go back to England.
And what do you remember about the trip back?
It was on a very much smaller boat than the trip outwards, and the conditions were very much rougher.
Do you remember the name of the ship?
No, I can't remember. I can't recall.
And what
it.
Month was it you went back? Would it be March?
I think it would be about Marchish, yes.
And anything about the voyage?
It was very, very, very cold. Because, again, these boats used to go up north to get in amongst the ice pack to avoid the submarines because they went unescorted. And by that time, it was very hard. The rules were very strict. You're only allowed in certain places at certain times. There was no messing about. And then we got to Liverpool. And from Liverpool, we got posted to Harrogate. And we all put up in the hotel there.
Did you go to Heaton Park first?
Heaton Park was the other way. Heaton Park was going. This was coming back.
Well, it says you went there in you're at Heaton Park for 2 months. 31 PD.
Yeah, what month was that? I can't recall. And once close it up, then they move it somewhere else.
So 31 PDC had gone to Harrogate.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, it's not important, really, because it was just...
So what happened at Harrogate?
At Harrogate, you went through all sorts of tests, and it was there, it was...
What kind of tests?
There was no flying there at all, it was hotels. And basically, what had happened by then, the war situation had changed, it had become stabilised, the Yanks were involved, they were in England. We were no longer sort of fighting with everything we had as we had, you know, almost 2 years earlier. And they had the vast, vast reservoir of pilots who were coming in from all over the world. The training scheme had produced so many pilots that they had an overwhelming number of pilots. And in fact, some of the pilots, and this was a scandal, became coal miners, some became engine drivers, some became glider pilots in the army. And the fear was that you would become one of those categories. That's how much everything had changed. So, in the end, I was told that I was remaining a pilot.
What were you doing in that couple of months, or month and a half? It's from March till May.
Sweating most of the time. Wondering and worrying. We got leave. We got home leave because we hadn't been home for a couple of years. So we got a couple of weeks leave, I think, if I remember. And then we went back there. And what happened was the same as when you were in Canada going out, was you just paraded every day in the morning and the afternoon, and they announced things to you, and you just listened. If it concerned you, you reacted, and if it didn't, you just went away and came back the next day.
So no duties?
No duties, no.
And you seem to have gone to 7PD, which...
I can't remember what that is. It's, you see, some of these... PDs. Let's look inside the book and see if it
You don't know what 7PD is.
No, I can't remember. It could not. They put you to all sorts of places where they could use you for something or other. And one time, I think we were shoveling coal for a power station. I can't remember. It wasn't significant.
Okay.
They used you as they needed you. You were manpower, but don't forget, you're in uniform and you could be pushed wherever they wanted. The next time I was flying again was to get my sort of air experience back, and they put us at a place called Desford, where we flew Tiger Moths.
Where? Desford?
I think it was Desford, yeah.
And that's 7 EFTS?
EFTS, yeah. You know, the aircraft were there. It was a grass field, so they pushed us all down there. And after a couple of duels to get us back to Solo Station, we were just told to go and fly every day. And virtually by the end of it, we could do what we liked with the aeroplane.
And so that was, roughly speaking, June to July.
Yeah, that was, if you like, refresher.
Right. Anything about that?
I can't recall anything significant. It was just a very, very ordinary field. It wasn't a runway airfield. It wasn't an important airfield. And I think they were just using the EFTS aircraft that were left there, standing there, just to keep us flying.
And back to, again, you said the Tiger Moth. But
yeah, that was only a few hours flying, but just got us back in the air.
So what next?
And the main thing was it got us flying under UK conditions of blackout and security. In Canada, of course, there'd be no blackout.
So, and that was Desford.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure where Desford is, but...
it's up in the Midlands somewhere, yeah.
We'll look it up.
What's this one?
Then the next thing, you go to 21 AFU.
Yeah, Advanced Flying Unit. Now, the Advanced Flying Unit, and it was on an Advanced Flying Unit, I was subsequently an instructor, it was designed to take you to the stage before operational training. In other words, to hone your flying skills under wartime conditions.
Now, this is at Tatton Hill in Staffordshire.
Tatton Hill, yeah.
Tatton Hill, sorry.
Which still exists, it's still a flying place.
And you went there in August.
Yeah.
And you're flying Oxfords again.
Yep.
Now, what do you remember about the training there? What the sort of thing? You're going through the same old exercises.
Refresher. Getting you really honed and skillful on the Oxford before you were going on to OTU, which would have been on something like Wellington's.
And anything happened while you're there?
Not that I can remember that was exceptional. I don't know how many hours I was there. I can't remember. I don't know how long I was there.
August and September flying.
Yeah.
Flights of normally about an hour and a half, hour and three quarters.
Yeah.
But nothing that you remember?
Nothing I remember. I mean, if they'd seen something that wasn't right, they'd have dealt with it. And if it wasn't, then I don't think the training taught us anything new, really, apart from blackout and UK radio sort of.
Well, let's go through them two things. We might as well clear. What is the blackout thing, then?
Well, the blackout thing is very serious. You've got to navigate properly, otherwise you're going to get lost.
So you'd have to navigate in blackout conditions?
In blackout conditions, yeah. In Canada, if you're flying, there's a lake, there's a river, there's a road, there's a railway, there are mountains, there are all sorts of things you can see, and which are waypoints, if you like, when you're flying. If you're going to fly at night in operations out over the North Sea to Germany, you've got to make certain that you get to where you're heading, and so you have to have very much more advanced flying skills, in other words, dead accurate flying on the heading. If you're going to fly 090 magnetic, you've got to fly 090 magnetic, not something wavering on either side of it. So you've got to be dead accurate in your instrument flying. And that was one of the things, if I recall, was one of the most important things. You take off on instruments and you go take up a heading on instruments. And these days it's called a heading. Then it was called a course, forgive me. So you've got to take up a course and you've got to fly dead accurately, the right airspeed, to take account of your navigational calculations. The other thing, of course, if the weather changes, if the wind changes, you would have set your course according to the wind as you knew it. If the wind changed radically, you'd be ending up somewhere else, so you've got to know how to correct.
Anything else? There's another thing you mentioned about
radio.
Now, what's the radio with the wireless conditions?
Well, the wireless conditions, first of all, there was security, so the minimum radio transmissions. But two, the type of radio was entirely different. When you got near to your station, you had to speak to them by radio. In the air, you had emergency frequencies, and you had operational frequencies. And there wasn't very much in the form of radio navigation in existence in those days. We did have one aid, which I think I'd do a special course on a little later on, which is called BEAM. And BEAM was a system which was stolen from the Germans, basically, where two radio waves...
Hang on, but you didn't do that with 21?
I think I did a detachment from there to Shawbury to do it.
Ah, yes, you do.
Yeah. So that's part of the course.
1534 bat flight.
Yeah, BEAM approach training course. And that was very, very important. And if anybody ever listens to this, they go along to Hendon, they'll see a BEAM training equipped Oxford sitting there to this day.
So tell me, so BEAM approach
the
training.
BEAM approach training is the precursor to today's ILS, and you had to fly it really, really accurately, and it was sometimes the only way you could get back to your airfield, assuming that the airfield had BAT.
Now, how did it all work?
It worked very simply.
As a pilot, you know.
Well, you've got a runway, and it's, let's say it's facing due east and due west, right? And you're landing from the west, okay? You're facing east as you're coming in. So you would find in the aircraft a little indicator which had two needles on it, one marked left and one marked right. And basically, a beam, a radio beam, was being projected from the runway installation, two of them side by side, one which was transmitting dots, dot, 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 and the other one which was transmitting dashes, dash, 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 dash. And they were so aligned that the beams, which were fan-shaped, but very narrow fans, would very slightly overlap on the middle. And if you were in the middle sector, you'd get a constant tone. Because the dots would intercept with the dashes. So the two of them together made a constant tone. And that was an oral signal, and also you had a signal of the two needles. So you had both. And the name of the game was to track, which means fly at such a course that, taking into account the wind effect, the net effect of the two would be that the airplane would go along in the right direction and come down the runway direction. However, that was only in one dimension. That was left and right. The other dimension is up and down, because you've got to go down to land. And here they had no equipment whatsoever. Today it's called the glide slope, but it didn't exist in those days. And the way you judged it was, they had three vertical signals called an inner, outer, and I forget what they called the middle one, central beacon. And these were signals which were just going straight up. And as you came along, you got to the first one, it was zzzz, and then you looked at your altimeter, you should have been, say, 1,200 feet. Okay? Now, you then started letting down at a measured rate, say 200 feet per minute. And then as you're going on, following with the overlap of the waves, that's a constant noise and the needles in the middle, you then come to the inner marker, and you should be at, let's say, 750 feet. Now, if you were higher, you increased your rate of descent, and if you were lower, you reduced your rate of descent. So by all sort of means, you judge whether your rate of descent was correct in terms of the profile to lead you to the end of the runway. It was rather chancy. And then you finally got the final inner marker, and you should be at 250 feet. Now, if you're under it, you've got a problem. You've got to pull up quickly. Lots of power and stick back. But if you were about right, then you carried on, and sooner or later, you'd see the glim lamps, which marked the each side of the runway, and then you took it visually from then on. So that was the only technology they had to bring you in bad weather at night.